Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the second episode of a new Empire podcast regular, The Interviews, rounding up our chats with the best and the brightest around. And we start off with the return of the Staith. Yes, Jason Statham himself, former diver, film star, kicker and puncher of faces on screen, of course, and national bloody treasure. His new movie, Shelter, sees him play a mysterious man, so mysterious his name isn't revealed until an hour or so into the movie, although Statham just goes ahead and says it right here, right out loud, who has become a recluse on a secluded Scottish island until a young girl comes into his life and dark threats from his past resurface, forcing him into desperate measures to keep them both alive. It's a grittier slice of Statham, this one, directed by Rick Roman Waugh, who usually teams up with Jerry Butler on the likes of Angel Has Fallen and Greenland. And when the two of them, Waugh and Statham, came into London last week, I jumped at the chance to chat to them in, yes, a London hotel room. And it was a giggle, as Statham and I both realised we've been doing this job for a long, long time. He's good at it. What's my excuse? I put in my 10,000 hours, still nothing. Anyway, here we go. Enjoy.
It's 25 years, Jesus. Can I just have an existential
moment? That's literally
moment?
The start of my career. You might have been the first interview I did.
I remember interviewing on Meme Machine.
Yeah.
Meme Machine.
That was a good 20 plus years ago.
Yeah, there's the Scottish goalkeeper.
That's it.
The monk.
The monk. Yeah, I've done some silly stuff, Rick. I prayed that you never saw any of that stuff, otherwise we wouldn't be doing Shelter.
Well, this is not silly stuff. This is a Shelter. Welcome to the Empire podcast. Jason Statham, the man we affectionately call the Staith, and Rick Roman Waugh, the man we affectionately call the War Machine.
Yeah,
I was trying to think of a nickname for you in the corridor, and I came up with the War Machine.
I've had a lot worse, trust me.
Jason, well, you may not remember this, but you came into the podcast years ago for Hummingbird, and I think I confessed that the nickname The Staith is something we came up with in Empire, but it is something that people call you in your everyday life?
Not every day, no. But I don't mind it. It's a good little moniker.
It's good.
I've kind of got used to it.
Over the years, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Shortening is always better, isn't it? You know?
Well, you want just, you know, taking out the thumb.
Yeah.
Just going straight for the
stage. It's got a bit of a ring to it, isn't it? I'll take that all day long.
Absolutely. And Rick, so you're not a nickname guy. The War Machine's not a new thing.
The interesting thing about this is Jason is extremely eloquent the way he speaks. Uh-huh. And I didn't want any nicknames. Like, I just call him Jason. And, you know, this has been a great, respectful kind of journey together.
Yeah.
On this. And I'm excited for people to see this movie.
This feels like a beautiful friendship that's going on here. Yeah. When did you guys first meet? Was it specifically to talk about this?
Okay. Right before we made the movie. Yeah, okay. Literally. We had a couple of phone calls, right, Rick? I was in Malta, actually. I was finishing up the film. We got on the phone. And, you know, I know about Rick and I know about his films. I know people that work with him. And he was always on my radar to try and, you know, chloroform him and get him to say yes. So, you have people that you want to work with. And, I think it's always, you throw an arrow at a target and you hope they're going to respond to the material. And, that's what happened. Rick saw the same film as I saw. Uh-huh. And he had a much better version of it. That's the one I wanted to make, not the one that I came up with.
What was your version? What did you?
A little bit less interesting, I would say. Less emotional core. So yeah. Rick brought out all that stuff, and I don't want to keep speaking for you, Rick, but the process you have. Oh, why don't you tell him? That 30,000 feet kind of look that we have.
Oh, yeah,
it really has to grab me in the gut. When I read the story, I'm a big fan of Jason. We've been wanting to work together. At least I've been wanting to work with him. But as you know, from my body work, I'm always trying to find something a little off center for myself, right? I can do action. Mm-hmm. I come from that world. Mm-hmm. But I'm also trying to find something that emotionally grips me because they're the stories that I love. And they're the movies that I used to watch. You know, the Sid and the Met movies and the old Westerns like Shane, which this story reminded me a lot of.
Yeah.
They're movies that have an emotional integrity to them. They have something to say. They're not stump speeches. They're not preaching to you. They relate to us. And Jason was really passionate about this. story that he pitched, and he's a little wrong. We had the same movie in mind. And when I read it, I got it. I just got about these two lost souls trying to find family, you know, at the core of this. And then you wrap that in a big action ride, you got something, yeah. You know, and yeah. I've just never been a fan of action movies for the sake of action, because they become mindless and our eyes glaze over no matter how many hundreds of millions we throw at it. Mm-hmm. We want to be gripped. We want emotion to be evoked. So this was right in my wheelhouse.
And Jason, in terms of it feels slightly outside your wheelhouse in a way. This character, I don't even want to say his name,
right?
Because it's kind of a plot point in the film. But we know nothing about this guy mm-hmm. for the first 30, 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. You barely speak mm-hmm. for the first 30, 40 minutes. You're just in that lighthouse being stoic and shutting the world out. Was that something that appealed to you, that's slightly outside the lines of...
Yeah, you know, in fact, we had a much longer intro. I mean, it was Rick's version. It was much more condensed. I mean, the whole setup was a very slow burn, which I loved. I really thought we could get in... It's kind of provocative to understand or get the audience to kind of wonder who this guy is, what does he stand for, where's his moral compass, what is he doing isolated... What, you know, there's a lot of questions get asked when you're not saying much and you're just sort of shuffling around in this house and, you know, you're having to deal with a young girl. And it was much more elongated. It was a much longer version that we had to sort of chop down a little bit, even though it seems quite lengthy to most sort of action movie goers. Mm. And I don't like to sort of frame this as a typical sort of action movie, you know, a programmer, as some people call them, that, you know, I've been known for doing in my past. I feel that this one had a much more deeper soul to the character. And like I said, the beginning was a much, much slower burn. So I think that when we put these movies in front of audiences, we have to kind of respond to their sort of anticipation on when's the story going to get going, you know?
Yeah.
There's a fine line and a balance, and I don't even want to speak about it.
It's that clickbait mentality we have now with social media, where you have to grab everybody in like 10 seconds. That's not what movies are supposed to be, right? Movies are supposed to be stories that unfold mm-hmm. in front of our eyes, and
yep.
a man that is starting as a mystery and playing that mystery and saves a young girl and then finding out her mystery, mm-hmm. and then... the wolves that have been hunting him for 10 years that are now coming into play, putting her in jeopardy. These things need time in a way that still, the fine line that I'm always playing as a filmmaker is remembering my commerciality and how a movie plays in a commercial sense. I want you to come to the theater for 2 hours. I want you to be on the edge of your seat. I want it to be this huge thrill ride, mm-hmm. but I want you to maybe have some tears in your eyes a little bit. And have some levity and have some laughs. Be emotionally engaged through it. And when you need that core, you need to set it up in a way where we're not doing every movie nowadays, cold opening, shock cut to just yes. big action.
Yep, yep.
Tell me everything right ahead. Tell me everything about the character right away.
Yep.
And then you're just watching things again, you know, just as an action run versus the way that we storytell. You know, we read a book, they don't tell me everything right from the top. And I Absolutely. Love that this has a narrative engine that is classic storytelling, but done in a commercial sense of one big action ride.
And in fact, I'll just add to that. I mean, we were suggested to do a cold opening, right?
Yeah, we were.
Yeah, we were saying there was conversations about, you know, we need to put something in at the beginning that sort of sets Mason up so we know who he is.
Oh, that's his name.
No, but we were quite adamant to yeah. kind of stick yeah. with the way it sort of unfolds in this provocative way.
No, I agree. And I also think that it's, I can imagine, you know, those classic stories of, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger only has 26 lines or whatever it is in the first Terminator movie, or Mel Gibson or Clint Eastwood going through yeah. the line, you know, the scripts of Mad Max or Good, Bad and Ugly, and ripping out lines because they don't want to say a lot. They want to communicate everything mm-hmm. through body language. I can imagine you did much the same with this. I mean, Mason, now his name's out there, doesn't speak. Like the words have to be almost grabbed out of him in a way.
Yeah, I mean, he's got this self-imposed sort of isolation, and he's not used to communicating. You know, he's a lost soul. He's not, you know, he's good at drinking, and he's good at burying his past.
Yeah,
you know, that's where his head's at. I mean, communication is not a skill set that he's got a blunt tool for that.
Yeah. But it is also, I mean, there are some great action sequences in this. There's an amazing nightclub shootout as well. And Jason, the last time you were on the podcast was with Guy Ritchie for Operation Fortune, and you were talking about how he likes to kind of just stage his action scenes on the day.
Yes, he does, yeah.
He just gets, starts improvising,
which seems
absolutely wild to me.
It is wild.
Yeah. Was that the case on this, or Rick, are you a little bit more straight and narrow?
I think that it really gets down to what I love about Jason and working with him is our chemistry. Right. You can put the most talent, not that we're the most talented people, but you can put the most talented people into a film. We've seen it where we've seen movies put every Academy Award winner in front of the camera. And we're like, what went wrong? And what went wrong is that there wasn't chemistry. You have to have a DNA with one another and understand the whole way of working, what you're trying to achieve. And what I love about Jason is I finally met somebody that is more of a juggernaut than myself about coming to set and being prepared for the day. He has this great energy about him, and his preparation is there so that when you do get to the day, you're not winging it. You're elevating it. If you have a foundation of what you want to achieve and everybody's a part of that collaboration, now you're raising the bar. You're not just trying to get to a level. And that's the difference. And that's where I think the action speaks for itself in this movie. It's fantastic. And coming from the stunt world, I'll tell you the BS lines I've heard from people, they do their own stunts. Well, there's no bullshit here because the camera's right here in his face doing the action. Yeah. And that's the difference is when you have somebody that can do a performance like this in the middle of doing the action as well. Yeah. I certainly couldn't do that, right?
I don't know about that, Rick.
No. Maybe do the action, but you'd see the oh shit factor in my face. But you would. But what you get with that is then you get performance and you get emotion. And what my job is coming from the world that I came from is that question I always got was, what was it like to do stunts? What they really mean is, what did it feel? What was the feeling of the was it the thrill ride? Was it being scared shitless? Was it the sense of fear?
Yeah.
And I want to do that with action. I want to put you in the car with this guy. I want to put you in the fights with him. I want to you feel the jeopardy. So that way there's an emotional attachment to the action. And you don't get that without having a guy that can do the action star, but then show you the performance at the same time.
Blimey.
Well, I'll tip my hat to you for the, you know, the car chase stuff can be quite, I don't know, car chases can be quite boring unless they're really excellent, you know? And it's hard to capture that sort of visceral sort of tension.
Yeah.
And, you know, Rick put cameras in there, you know, strapped sort of cameraman down to the seats. You know, he really wanted this to be in through the lens. You know, we didn't do it. We were very, very conscious of not, you know, leaning on anything like CG that was, you know, just an easy get out.
No, it feels so visceral and real.
We were really pushing ourselves to make it feel gritty and real.
And Jason, we started off by talking about the fact I've been at Empire now for 25 years. And
we've made you a cake, actually.
No, please, the cake. Please. Just be to plunge my face into to try and forget about everything else. But, you know, our paths crossed pretty much soon after on Mean Machine. And, you know, you've been doing this now for 25, 30 years yourself. So how do you keep that energy up for these incredible action sequences? I mean, I'd break a hip if you know, I were doing what you were doing.
I love it. You know, if I didn't love it, I wouldn't be able to get excited for it. I love what we do. I love the process. I love the challenge. And it's the reward is there when it's over. I mean, that's all I've got to say.
Is it getting tougher, though?
Huh?
Is it getting tougher?
Yeah. You guessed it. Listen, you ain't 21 forever. You know, but you have to work harder. You have to work harder to maintain what you have. It's like there's a lot more sort of dedication that you have to do to keep things from snapping and breaking. The best you can. Yeah.
You see, here's the difference. If there was a cake right now, I could have that cake. But you can, right?
We can have the cake.
You can have the cake?
Yeah, I've got kids. You know how much cake I eat a week? It's about 8 kilos.
Oh, my God. And then the hard yards in the gym afterwards.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, I hope this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship. You know, indeed. You know, Rick, obviously you've made 47 movies with Jerry Butler, but you can make 47 now with Jason.
This place.
Make it happen. The Staith, the War Machine. What a pleasure. Thanks very much.
What a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, that was Jason, the Staith, Statham, and Rick Roman, the War Machine, War, talking about Shelter, which is out in cinemas right now, folks. Not out in cinemas right now is Derek Cian France's excellent dramedy Roofman, but it has just landed on shiny discs, so you can watch it in the comfort of your own home. In case you missed it, when it opened last October, it stars Channing Tatum as an escaped con who hides out from police by living inside a Toys R Us. And as he becomes more brazen about his new temporary life, he even starts a relationship with a Toys R Us employee, played by Kirsten Dunst. Incredibly, this is based on the true life story of one Jeffrey Manchester. And when I spoke to Cian France, we spoke a lot about his contact with Manchester, who is not by the sea, but still in prison. Cian France, of course, is the director of films like The Place Beyond the Pines and Blue Valentine, a film for which he wanted to cast Channing Tatum. And Roofman, although overlooked in the Oscar conversation, is up there with those movies. It's beautifully bittersweet, and Tatum has never been better. Check it out. And check out this interview with Cian France as well. Enjoy.
Derek Cian France, director of Roofman. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me.
No, it's a pleasure to have you here. Or should I say Dr. Derek?
Dr. Derek, that's right.
Dr. Derek.
As Jeff calls me.
Yeah, absolutely. When did he start calling you Dr. Derek and why?
Maybe, he's in a maximum security prison. He's been in prison for, I guess, around 30 years now. Mm. Of those 30 years, he spent 9 of those in solitary confinement. The events of Roofman, after the events of Roofman, they were very mad at him. So solitary confinement is, 23 and a half hours a day. Jesus. Alone in a room, 8x6 cell, no daylight. 9 years like that. So I think when I started talking to him, the first thing I was impressed by was his optimism, his humor. I was just like blown away by it. And I don't know, maybe after like 3-4 months of talking to him, he started calling me Dr. Derek. I learned a lot of things. I would ask him, I would say, how are you still so jovial and positive, when you've been in prison for this long? How, 9 years in solitary confinement, you still seem... You haven't lost your spark. And he said, well, in solitary confinement, he built houses in his brain. He said that he would spend 6 months, all those 23 hours a day, imagining that he had $100,000 and he was going to build a house for his family. And that each he would know the size of every room. Every one of his children would have their own room. He would know what the fixtures were like on the faucet. He would know what the hinges were like on the door. And after he would live fully in that house for 6 months, he would give himself $1 million and then build himself $1 million house with bigger rooms and maybe a pool. Uh-huh. And I realized, and so the more questions I asked him, the more he would kind of open up his subconscious to me and his imagination to me.
Wow.
And so it was like a really, I have a special relationship with Jeff.
My God, that is astonishing. And not to get too much into the US justice system and the penal system, but that seems punitive and beyond the extreme.
The thing about Jeff is he was offered a 7-year plea deal. Mm-hmm. And for the McDonald's robberies, and he said, 7 years, my kids will be teenagers by the time I come out of here. Mm. He was like, I didn't hurt anyone. He was like, I'm going to fight this. So he didn't really have any money. He had a public defender. The judge who I've spoken to, she's actually in the film. She plays the prosecutor in the film, but she told me that it was important to her that the kids, because it was some high school students that he put inside the freezers at McDonald's. Even though he made sure they had their jackets, she said she wanted those kids to see justice and to know that you couldn't do this and to feel better. And so they threw the book at him. And he went from 7 years to 45 years in like the blink of an eye. And
because they threw kidnapping in as a...
Huh? They only got him for one robbery, but I think they gave him 15 years for every person he put inside that freezer. And I can't speak to like her judgment. It does seem like a long time to me. It seems like people that, get you know, that kill people don't sometimes stay in prison for that long. I know Jeff thought it was too long, and that's why he broke out.
Yeah, and now he's added on top as well. But it is extraordinary to me, Derek, that you do have the judge in your movie.
Yeah.
Not to give things away, obviously, but we do meet at the end of the film as well. We do meet people who were involved in Jeff's story and Jeff's case.
Yeah.
And we see the real life people at the end of the movie. And you've studied people I know throughout the film in little cameos here and there as well. Was that important to you in a way to start the movie with people who have been exposed to A, Jeff, and B, the real thing, but also have people from all over the map in terms of how they felt about him as well?
Yeah, it was important to me because, you know, I spent like probably 400 hours on the phone with Jeff in the Dr. Derek phase. and it was midway through that process, I started to think to myself, is this guy just telling me a tall tale, or is this true? And so I had to talk to other people just to validate it, to validate a couple of things, to validate one, the story that I was hearing. Uh-huh. And so I talked to the police and talked to the judge and talked to the dentist whose office he burned down to understand, oh, all these things did happen that he was telling me about. But then I also had to talk to the people in his life that he had relationships with. Not everyone would talk to me, but the people who would talk to me, I had to talk to them to validate the feelings I had for Jeff. Because I was like, am I just being manipulated by him?
Yeah.
You know, and because I did like him as a person, you know, too. And so I talked to Lee and to Pastor Ron, and both of them, you know, I expected them to be angry at him, feel betrayed, but they both spoke about him as if he was like this unicorn that entered their lives. And they had lived long lives. They're both in their 50s and 60s, and they talked about him as like this jewel of their experience. Lee said he was the greatest adventure of her life. And so I thought that the movie should feel like that.
Yeah.
It should feel like what it was like at that moment for them to be together. And there's a flip side to that coin too, because there's a lot of pain and a lot of tragedy that happens because of that. So it's, you know, the roller coaster of this movie is, you know, the hills are high. Mm. You know, the slopes are pretty steep. So I wanted to shoot it then down in Charlotte where the events took place in twofold then, because I wanted to be surrounded, because it was so crazy. Like, the key to movies is suspension of disbelief. And I felt like I needed to shoot in Charlotte to suspend my disbelief because I had to shoot it in the actual church where Lee and Jeff met, because that I needed to be in the place to just kind of experience the ghosts of that history.
Wow.
You know, just for my own, so I could believe it. And then I wanted to have all those people in the movie because I wanted this to be a positive experience for everyone involved. And I wanted to make sure that they could come into the movie and sometimes play themselves, but sometimes play other people and see things from a slightly different perspective on the scene. And, you know, it's intense telling a story about a real person and real people that are still alive. And what I just didn't want to do is be the Hollywood film that came to town and pushed everyone out of the way. You know, it was like a very expensive choice to shoot in North Carolina.
Yeah,
I had a lot of people say you should shoot this movie in South Africa or Bulgaria because you'll be able to build everything. You can do everything you want. And I was like, yeah, but the people.
Yeah.
Are there. And I didn't want to just run roughshod over the story and the people and the feeling. So I did it there just for authenticity and for home. You know, this movie's about a guy trying to make a home. And I felt like I had to go to the place where it happened. And I'll tell you one thing. I'm sorry, I'm going all over the place. But I was my first scout down in North Carolina. I was looking for a fast food restaurant. Because all the McDonald's had changed over the years, right?
Of course, yes.
Modern structures of McDonald's are different than they were 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So I was in a Popeyes restaurant, and there was the manager of the Popeyes fried chicken place. And within 5 minutes, this manager, she had invited me to her home for dinner. And I realized that this was the type of community that would welcome a stranger in off the street. And you can't fake that.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that. I want to get into the tonal tightrope in a way that you have to walk with this movie in a second. But just hear what you were saying there about Jeff and Jeff and his story and the fact that he's in solitary confinement for 23 and a half hours a day. Mm-hmm. He obviously hasn't seen the film.
No.
I'm guessing he hasn't seen any of your work. Has he, or has he been able to?
He hasn't, because they're not playing Blue Valentine in prison, it turns out.
They're not going, they're making a movie of your life, Jeff. Here's a place beyond the pines.
No.
So you can see what Derek's done.
No.
They're not doing that.
No, he had to trust me as just a person. He told me at one point, he was like, Derek, this is my story, but it's your movie, and I trust you, and I want you to tell it in the way that you see fit. And I was like, okay, it's going to be different. I'm not making a documentary, Jeff. I'm not making a journalistic piece. I'm going to make the cinematic truth here. Yeah. And he was like, and Jeff loves movies, so he was fine with that. And, you know, there were certain people in his life that didn't want to talk to me before the movie, certain family members.
Yeah.
And in the time since the movie has come out now in the States, some of those family members have now seen the film and they have gotten in touch with me. And I've heard from a number of them that the movie has brought them closer to him.
Yeah.
And Jeff called me last week and he said, Derek, if I could hug you, I would. He was like, I had a call with my sister. She answered the phone and he said, it was like we were in high school again.
He said,
there was nothing between us. He was like, I got to thank you so much. And so I think the real connections between him and his world and his family are you'll kind of make the whole movie worth it to me.
Oh,
because he's, you know, when you go and visit someone in prison, I rode elevators with mothers and fathers and sisters and brothers and aunts and uncles who are all visiting family members of that were locked up in prison, of people that had made huge mistakes, people that had hurt people. But I realized they all had families on the outside who still loved them and still cared for them and maybe were angry with them for their decisions that they made, but they were still people behind bars. And my impression of seeing Jeff behind bars was, here was a man, human, who I'd know very well, and he was caged. And I felt like he's still a person and still worthy of humanity. And I think especially for Jeff's story, I think it was his humanity that made him a worse criminal.
Yes.
You know, I think if he had been more of a cold-hearted criminal, we wouldn't know his story.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was that, that made him worthy of this whole process.
It's not just the fact that he hid out in a Toys R Us and in real life a Circuit City as well,
but
that he went out and forged bonds in the community and had a relationship with Lee.
Yeah.
And, you know, he had a craving, I think, for connection that
100%
still, I imagine, is obviously being denied to him to this day. But that those connections, I think, are one of the reasons why I love the movie. I think it's such a beautiful, warm human film. But in terms of talking about the emotional tonal tightrope that you have to walk, you fall in love with these characters.
Mm-hmm.
And in the back of your mind, you know, tragedy or something bad is going to happen. This is not going to end well.
Yeah.
Because I know that Jeff Manchester is in prison. Can you talk about traversing that as a director, approaching that?
Ultimately, life doesn't end well for any of us.
That's a very good point. Spoiler alert.
Yeah. It kind of sucks, but it's beautiful. It's like it only sucks because how great it is.
Yeah.
You know, and I was thinking, my wife's a comedian, and but she's more serious in real life. And me, I usually make tragedies, but I'm maybe more fun-loving in real life. And I started to realize that comedy and tragedy are flip sides of the same coin.
Very much so,
and that this movie, maybe I could flip that coin in the air and you could see both faces at once because it was spinning so fast. And it got me thinking, like, I've always thought you slip on a banana peel and people laugh, but it hurts.
Yeah.
And so there's I used to think, looking at the comedy and tragedy faces, that the one that was smiling was the tragedy face, because that's what you laugh at. The serious one the serious one was the comedy face, because you laugh at pain.
Yeah.
And because what else are you going to do?
It's a natural instinct.
It's a natural instinct. Yeah. And so I thought this movie could live in that kind of slip, you know, that pain comedy place. And it was a very, very intense balancing act. There's a moment where Peter Dinklage, you know, gets hit in the face with like a dye pack, and he comes out and he's like blinded, and he bumps into all these Christmas presents. And I remember being on set that day, because we were trying to find it, you know, find in every, we were always walking the tightrope on set to try to find that moment. I remember half of my crew was aghast and the other half of my crew was laughing. And I felt like that's the place where this movie has to live, was and in terms of like the criminal and the human, it kind of walks that line the whole time. And I think I love the contradiction of that. I love the juxtaposition of that. And it's, it's a tightrope, as you say.
Absolutely. But one of the reasons that it works is the performances. Performances. I'm a writer. Yes. I should know that. And
yes. Time to start cursing.
Sorry, I'll fix it in post. Janine and Kirsten are so tremendous together.
Mm, they are.
And I know that you wanted him to star in Blue Valentine years ago, and he thought he wasn't ready to do that. Now, 15 years later, 14 by the time you filmed the movie, you went back again. And this time he was ready to do it, because he really goes to some interesting places in this. What convinced you that he was ready this time? Was it a case of him feeling ready?
Yeah. I mean, I will say about the whole Blue Valentine thing, I got rejected by a lot of people. Like, no, because, and it wasn't until Ryan Gosling and Michelle Williams like believed in me that I got a chance. I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for Ryan and Michelle saying like, okay, we trust you. Mm. I think when I met Channing all these years later, I think it was when I first saw, I had a meeting with him in Prospect Park. And
6-hour meeting, right?
Yeah, 6-hour meeting. And I saw him and he was sitting there and I was like, hey, we've actually met before. Do you remember? We met like 17 years ago when I offered you Blue Valentine. And he was like, I think about it all the time. He was like, how did you know that was me? And I was like, well, next time I offer you something, just say yes.
Yeah.
And, but Channing's one of those actors that is like, first image of him I saw, and the reason I was interested to work with him, was in Guide to Recognizing Your Saints. Mm. He was like this first time I saw him, he was walking down the street, shirt off. I think he had a vest on, but his shirt off underneath. His body was like a dancer's body, and his face was like a boxer's face. It was like Gene Kelly and Marlon Brando. And I was just like, I've never seen anything like him. It was like a vision of this wounded, beautiful, bruised masculinity. And he said no, but then I kept going to his films, and he was like such a great romantic lead, and he was like such an amazing action star, and as a comedian, he has like some of the most iconic moments in movies in the last 20 years, and then he's like super vulnerable in Foxcatcher, and then, you know, he's also making biopics of his own life. As a dancer. And I was like, he's also courageous. So when I met with him, I didn't tell him anything about the movie. I just had a 6-hour walk in the park with him and just learned about him as a person. And he had a lot in common with Jeff. Jeff has like a real connection to his inner child. Mm. I always thought he's like a little bit of a Peter Pan character. Mm. And Channing was like that too. Like I kind of imagined Channing as like the tramp, like Charlie Chaplin's the tramp. He's got like a child's heart in a man's body.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, it's kind of him. And I called my co-writer right afterwards and I was like, I think it's Channing. So, you know, we'd spent like 3 years talking to Jeff, and then I was like, let's spend the next period of time. It turned out to be like 9 months where we just focused on Channing's voice coming through the words. And we kind of rewrote it specifically for him and gave it to him. And I was like, like a dream. And then Kirsten was the same way for me. Like I think she's like a absolute unicorn of a person, because like she's a child actor who has we've all grown up with her, mm-hmm. right? We've all watched her and been like in awe of her. And somehow she is a regular person, you know? I don't know how she's done that, but it's, she's so normal.
Yeah.
She's just like the greatest actor of her generation.
Yeah, she's amazing.
And it hasn't gotten to her head. It hasn't changed her. And she's a mom, you know, and I think their kids are her most important thing in her life. And I remember when I told Channing that I was going to cast Kirsten, he got super nervous, and because she's so good. Mm. And I think he was maybe intimidated by that, by working with an actor of her caliber. Because mm. I think all actors know that Kirsten is the real deal.
No, she's amazing. Yeah. That final scene, Jesus.
I know.
Extraordinary stuff.
I agree.
Extraordinary. Well, Derek, I've got to let you go. But it's just occurred to me that Jeff obviously hasn't seen your work. He won't have seen any of Channing's work. He might have seen some of Kirsten's.
He's seen Channing's work.
Oh, he's seen Channing's work? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he loves Logan Lucky. They played that in prison. Yes. When I first told him that I cast Channing, he was like, Channing Tatum, you got to find someone uglier. And then I got him in touch with Channing. He called Channing and he called me and he's like, Derek, I have to compliment you. You did a really wonderful job casting this film because Channing and I actually have so much in common. We both play defensive end. We both have extremely high motors and we're both incredibly good looking.
It's like looking in a mirror, only not. Amazing. Derek Cianfrance, what a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Pleasure is mine.
Okay, that was Derek Cianfrance. And Roofman is out now in all home entertainment formats, shiny discs, streaming, you name it. Get your copy now at Toys R Us. And now one last interview to go. You're about to hear an excerpt from our spoiler special interview with Nia DaCosta, the director of the excellent horror sequel 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple. Our spoiler special for that is now live on the spoiler special feed for all spoiler special subscribers. And if you don't spoiler special subscribe to that, then here is a taste of Ben Travis's Zoom chat with her. Needless to say, this is spoiler filled. So if you haven't seen The Bone Temple, perhaps give this one a swerve because there are spoilers from the off, or wait until you've seen it before giving this a go. For the rest of you who have seen it and want to hear some spoilers, enjoy.
It is my pleasure to welcome to the Empire spoiler special for 28 Years Later, The Bone Temple, director Nia DaCosta. Nia, the film is about to come out. How are you feeling this week?
I feel great. I'm like, I love the film so much. I'm really proud of it. And I'm just really excited for everyone to see it.
As always, it's tradition on these spoiler specials just to go in on the big stuff straight away. Because you haven't been able to talk about any of this for months and months and months.
Yeah.
First up, I want to ask, what was your reaction to what I'm going to call the Iron Maiden scene? Because that was just such a joy to discover what that scene was in the film. I had seen bits of images that we had in the magazine. You see clips of it in the trailer. If you had asked me, what do I think is happening in that sequence? Never in a million years would I have guessed what actually was going on in that scene. It was incredible.
Yeah, it was really funny because when Sony Marketing showed us the first poster they wanted to do, I was like, this image is beautiful, but like, does it give anything away? And then we were like, no one's going to know what the hell. There's no way anyone can guess what the hell is happening. So it, like, let's go for it. Let's show, you know, crazy rave. When I read that in the script, I was like, this is so cool, but how the hell am I going to pull this off? Like, that was, I think that scene and also the infected fight scene in the train, I think we were all sort of like, oh God, like these could go really wrong. if they're not done well. And so those were the two scenes, I think, where we had the most sort of constant development. Like, we started really early on those. Like, it was something that the producers and I talked about a lot. And then, you know what, they just left us to figure out the best thing. And I think, especially with Iron Maiden, we really did. That sequence is one of my favorite things I've ever directed. It was so fun to develop with my Gareth and Carson, my production designers, and Shelley Maxwell, a choreographer, and Rafe. And, you know, it was just phenomenal fun.
And does it say Iron Maiden in the script? Is that then a conversation where you're like, we have to make sure we can get Number of the Beast for this scene?
By the time all the Duran Duran is written into the script and Iron Maiden is written into the script. So, like, literally, Alex had written, like, you know, Kelson dances over here. And then he had, like, the lyrics. So, like, the whole song, like, it basically was like Kelson dancing, going here, here, here. The song, and then, like, Samson gets out of the train, and then and then the end. The specifics of the performance are completely different because, you know, obviously when you're writing a script, you don't have a location, you don't know what's actually going to be able to happen. But we found all these different elements that we wanted to put together, and like the Ring of Fire and the fire dancer at the end, and the look, like that was all found during prep.
And also Rafe's performance, right? Because how Rafe playing this like outlandish sort of cartoonish idea of what Satan might be, but that is very believable to the Jimmies in that moment. Yeah. What did it take for you as a director to like get him there? Was he already like loose and limber for that? Or did you have to work on getting him
to,
into...
I didn't have to loosen him up at all. Like he was limber as hell. He's also in great shape. I think he was happy to get his kid off. He was like, let's go. Like, cause he just like, he was so like, Rafe is so down. And I think he also, I think the way we all did really responded to like the beauty of the script, the hope in the script, and like the sort of humanist ethos that that Kelson has as a character. And we also all connected to the fact that he's like this 80s guy who loves to dance, you know? And so for him, like that Iron Maiden sequence is like, he's literally, you know, someone said he's literally lip syncing for his life, you know? And you
that's
know,
incredible.
No, yeah, I was like, he literally is lip syncing for his life. And it is, and it's a powerful scene because it's at once fun and something he'd want to be doing anyway, but it's also like the stakes are super high.
Let's talk about the very, very end, because that's something that you definitely won't have been able to talk about. The return of Jim, the return of Cillian Murphy. We spoke for the Empire magazine feature about how huge a fan you are of the original film of 28 Days Later. In fact, before we talk about Jim coming back, let's talk about the very opening of your film, I believe. The audio we hear over the black screen is Cillian Murphy's hello from 28
Days Later. I'm so glad you said that, because I was like, did no one notice? I thought it was very clever that I did that. no, yeah. So basically that came from, you know, I always wanted to make sure that when you're in the film, what you see as like the title is the Bone Temple. I didn't want to do like 28 Years Later, the Bone Temple. So we wanted to put 28 Years Later at the top. But I was looking at the other films and I'm like, they all have like a scene. And then the title is the super telling us how much time has passed. So just to put 28 Years Later at the top felt kind of wrong. So I thought, let's do it with sound. We'll hear like the beginnings of it. We'll hear all the things that happened while Jim was in the hospital, for some reason completely naked. And then we'll end that with the hello. And then what everything that happens is 28 years later after the hello.
And it means that you begin and end the film with Jim. I mean, people know, because Danny Boyle has been talking quite openly for a while now, that Cillian is back. But at the same time, there is so much going on through the rest of the film with the Jimmies and with Samson and with Kelson. You kind of forget that it's, you're going to get that little taste of Jim at the end. How was that scene, that final scene, that coda, how was that described in the script? What was there on the page for you from Alex?
Well, I thought what was great about that scene was like, it was so measured. It wasn't like a bombastic, like he could have easily done like, you know, an axe flies through the sky and lands in an infected skull. Like Jim takes his gun, you know, it could have been something crazy, but he was like, no, this is not that franchise. This is about, we're meeting this man teaching his daughter about history and giving her tea and toast and them in the same house that we saw at the end of the first film. And I thought it was really beautiful that that's how we meet him again. And also the way the film ends with her saying, are we going to help them? And he says, of course we are. It just tells you everything this series of movies is about, which is about humanity and kind of, and again, being kind of humanist and relying on each other and choosing to do good.
And in your film in particular, there is a real emphasis on like, how do people live in this world? And you have that distinction between Jimmy and how the Jimmies live, what their way of life is, what their constructed belief is. We have that with Kelson. We see his day-to-day life. I'm going to get to all of this down the line.
Yeah.
We see what his way of life is. Both of them have had to create new ways of living because of everything that's happened. Then there is an incredible contrast with this scene with Jim at the end, where he's a normal guy living a normal life in these extraordinary circumstances. And it seems like rather than constructing a new way to live, he is a character who is holding on to the history, into the knowledge that the substance of the conversation that he's having with his daughter is like, oh, there are normal people on this island. We love Kelson, but he's not a normal dude.
Yeah.
Jim, there's that line from Kelson about the foundation of things that just seems to have slipped away. And it feels like Jim is holding on to the foundations of how things used to be.
Yeah. Well, I think he just knows, like, you know, it's why we all should learn history. You know, he's talking about like the end of fascism, you know, never to return, LOL. You know, he's like, he's, I think for him, he's like, it's important to remember these things so we don't repeat the nonsense of the past. But also I think it's important as a person to know your history and know where you come from and what you come from and what this world is born of. And for the fact that, you know, Jim was a bicycle messenger when we met him in the first film. And I think what I love actually about this scene is like, it's a kind of in direct contrast to Jimmy's first scene in the first film, where you see this child experienced a great trauma and then that's what his life is. And he never learns anything else beyond that. And then you have Jim's daughter who gets to learn and understand and be safe and feel protected and hopefully become a great person who doesn't start a sadistic cult. And it really is like, you know, I believe the children are the future sort of situation. Teach them well and let them lead the way.
Yeah. And obviously then you have Spike as a character who is journeying through this to try and figure out his own way to live.
Yeah. I think so. Spike's the sort of the thread through all the films. And he, you know, in the first film, he has kind of has like a hero's journey, coming of age. He leaves home, the prodigal son. But, you know, when we leave home, we find our trials and tribulations of the real world. And he is in over his head and he doesn't have his dad to come and protect him or to save him at the last minute. He has to figure out how to do this on his own. But again, he's seeing examples of like what you could choose. You can choose the sadistic horror, or you can choose like what Kelson does at the end, risk his life to save someone because it's the right thing to do. And to have those examples in front of you, I think it just tells us more and more about Spike's journey and his coming of age.
Had wondered if we might see Spike's dad at any point in this film. There's no Aaron Taylor Johnson here. Was that ever a consideration?
No. Yeah, no. Because again, it's not about like dad coming to save the day. It's about like, you've made this choice. Now, how do you live with it? What does that look like for you now?
Well, a last question on Jim before I move on. You've already mentioned that that other character with Jim is Jim's daughter. I assumed that was the case, but interesting to hear you say that. Is that Jim and Selena's daughter, Naomi Harris's character?
Yes.
And was there ever talk of Naomi appearing in this film?
I came into the movie with the scripts as they were and with the characters in them as they were. Mm. I don't know how things are going to continue, but that's all I will say about that.
Yeah, we'll do spoilers for the Bone Temple and not for whatever part three
exactly,
is.
Exactly, yeah.
But that character, the daughter character, is that Maya Eastman? Did I see the name in the credits? And what can you tell me about casting that character?
Oh, it was really fun. Danny and Gail, his casting director, he's forever. We kind of both were looking out, but he found her. She's an amazing like stage actress. Yeah, she's cool.
Well, we've been talking about how all these characters live and that glimpse at the end of how Jim lives. But let's talk about Kelson's life, because that is one of my favorite things from the film, is seeing Ralph Fiennes, seeing Dr. Kelson just go about his day singing Girls on Film to himself. You already said the Duran Duran was already all in the script. What was it like for you discovering Kelson's life in the script, and how did you want to bring that to the screen?
It was really nice. It was great to kind of build Kelson as a character. You know, we get a new set for him, basically the bunker where he sleeps. We get to see like the books that are in there, the records that are in there. A lot of dried poppies, because you're like, is that how he's, you know, fabricating his essentially his morphine, his sedative. And we get to just see like how lonely he is as well. And you can assume that he's lonely because he's by himself putting bones onto trees and making art out of them in a memorial. But I think you really understand why he becomes so curious about and risks, frankly, his life to explore his relationship with Samson, because he has no one else. And I also think he's kind of memento mori, he says, you know, he's accepted his death. So I think he's also willing to risk his life if it means that there's something new that he can learn. You know, his curiosity, I think, is really drives him. And so those are the things I was super excited about with exploring for him.
It does feel like, obviously, we don't know exactly how much has happened for him in the intervening 28 years, but you do get the sense that he has lived a certain way for a good long while, and this is a point in his life where he does see a chance to live, to experiment in that relationship with Samson, and that, yeah, maybe he has been quite like stagnant for a while, but this is him sort of coming back to life in a way. What can you tell me about that?
Yeah, no, I think 1,000%. I think a couple of things lit him up. One was meeting Alfie or Spike and his mother, and that relationship. You know, he says, "I've been waiting, you know, years for someone to ask me what this building is. You know, this monument is." And then the other thing is like realizing that there's something maybe more going on behind the curtain with the infected, with Samson in particular. I think everyone can kind of identify with like having periods where you're just going through the motions and then having something that like reignites you. And he has that in a very extreme way because he lives alone in the apocalypse. So it's like, you know, getting to see his character in this moment in his life is, I think, really illuminates a lot about him and the themes of the film.
Okay, that was Nia DaCosta talking to Ben Travis about 28 years later, The Bone Temple, which is still in cinemas now and as well worth your time. Also well worth your time, if you want to hear more about the themes of the film, is the Bone Temple Spoiler Special, which features the full version of that interview, about another 25-30 minutes, something like that, and an excellent hour-plus discussion about the film featuring Ben, Helen O'Hara, Mike Munzer, and, sorry to disappoint you, me. It's on our Spoiler Special feed right now. If you don't already subscribe, I can very much recommend it. It's £3.49 a month, for which you get brand new Spoiler Specials every month dedicated to the biggest and best new films and geek-friendly TV shows, your Star Wars, your Marvels, your DCs, your Aliens, and access to our ever-growing archive of Spoiler Specials, many of which feature incredible in-depth interviews with some of the greatest filmmakers on the planet. We're closing in on 500 Spoiler Specials alone, thousands of hours of listening right there for you. So it is a hell of an investment for the price of a coffee, or if you're at an airport, a bottle of water. Okay, that is enough for me. Well, almost. The new episode of The Shameless Plug, in which Empire editor Nick Desemlian and I talk about the new issue of Empire, our Lord of the Rings 25th anniversary celebration, that's out now, as is the brand new Empire Podcast Mothership episode, featuring plenty of film-related fun and a lovely chat with Is This Thing On's director, co-writers, and stars, Bradley Cooper and Will Arnett. Okay, that is definitely it from me now. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Interviews. See you next time. Bye-bye.